Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Duchenne, Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute. Welcome to the Michael Lazaridis Theater of Ideas and tonight's lecture by Russell Smith. So, of course, this is all part of Einstein Fest as we look at the miracle year 1905. And as I was planning the festival, thinking of all the things that we wanted to do surrounding 1905, placing Einstein and his work in context, I wanted to do something about fashion. And was searching around for somebody to do this lecture, and I was talking to my friend and colleague Irina Harris, and she said, "Oh, get Russell Smith, he'll be perfect." And I thought, it was a little surprising to me, only because I'd read some of Russell's novels, and he wasn't the first person who came to mind, but Irina said, "Oh, just ask Russell, he can do anything." So having never met him before in my life, I called him up and I said, "Hey, Russell, Irina Harris says you can do anything. Do you want to do this?" And we chatted for 2 minutes. And in fact, after 2 minutes, I realized she was right. He was just the guy to do this. So we're delighted to have him with us tonight. Russell Smith is an author of 6 works of fiction, a well-known journalist and cultural commentator. He writes the weekly virtual culture column in the Globe and Mail. Russell was born in Johannesburg, South Africa, and emigrated to Halifax. He studied French literature at the University of Poitiers in France, Queen's University, and the University of Paris. In 1989, he moved to Toronto, where he began to publish articles in magazines as a freelancer. And he has since gone on to publish articles on a variety of subjects for Flair, the Globe and Mail, the New York Review of Books, Details, Travel and Leisure, Toronto Life, En Route, Toro, and many others. For almost 2 years, he wrote a popular weekly column in the Globe and Mail on men's clothing and appearance. He wrote his first novel, How Insensitive, in 1992. It was nominated for the Governor General's Award, the Trillium Award, and the Chapters Books in Canada First Novel Award, and became a bestseller in Canada. His collection of stories, Young Men, was nominated for the Toronto Book Prize and the Danuta Gleed Literary Award. One of the stories in this collection, Party Going, won the National Magazine Award for Fiction in 1997. He has also written a novella, The Princess and the Whiskheads. Muriela Pent is his most recent novel, and he has published short fiction and poetry in a variety of journals. He's currently working on Russell Smith's Style, a sociological guide to men's clothing to be published by McClellan and Stewart in the fall of 2005. We're delighted to have him with us tonight. Please welcome Russell Smith.
Thank you. Am I on? You can hear me? Yeah. Thank you very much, Michael. And I'm really thrilled to be here involved in this. It's a real honor to be around so many interesting people and a part of this festival, and I'm very grateful. By the way, that book you just mentioned has just come out, and it's called Men's Style. I will promise you there will be no physics at all in this lecture. I'm going to start, well, we're talking about fashion in 1905. I'm going to start 100 years before. Just to give you a sense of contrast, we often have a sense of fashion moving from the uptight to the more relaxed in an uninterrupted arc. We picture people hundreds of years before us wearing extremely tight and uncomfortable and prudish clothing, and our own clothing being extremely flamboyant and sexual. In fact, it doesn't go that way. It goes in cycles up and down. This is a famous socialite of the Napoleonic era in France called Madame Récamier. She ran one of the most famous salons in Paris, and she was painted by a number of different painters. That's by David, that's actually 1800. That one is by Gérard, and it's 1802. And as you can see, she's practically naked, and that is actually how people dressed as they went to salons. Napoleon was preoccupied with the values and aesthetics of ancient Greece and Rome. And so everybody followed the emperor's tastes with their own tastes. You can see even the furniture in both cases is neoclassical. And the clothing is supposed to look Hellenic. It's supposed to look like the drapery on classical statuary. You can notice her feet are bare in both of these paintings. Her shoulders are bare in this one. She's showing a great deal of cleavage. The fashion historian James Lavery has written, perhaps at no period between primitive times and the 1920s had women worn so little as they wore in the early years of the 1900s. All female attire seemed to have been designed for tropical climates. And this is actually called a robe en chemise, and it looked something like a nightie. And it was often so transparent that it required white or pink tights underneath. And sometimes the material was dampened to cling to the body like the drapery in Hellenic statuary. Now, at this time, now I'm going to just quickly go over the rest of the fashion of the 19th century. I'm not going to show you a lot of slides because we wouldn't have time to go through all of those developments. I'm going to tell you briefly about how men's clothing evolved as well. But what I really want to focus on is how the fabric gradually increased as we get to the year in question. And there are various theories you can come up with as to why fashion became in many ways more conservative as the 19th century went on. I'll just tell you quickly an overview of the evolution for men and women of 19th century fashion. Men at this time, aristocrats would have looked very different from anybody else. And particularly before the French Revolution, aristocrats wore a great deal of finery. Even at this time in the Napoleonic era, and in Europe right up until about the 1840s, 1850, very privileged men still wore knee breeches and hose. And they wore a cutaway jacket with tails, which is called a frock coat. And over the course of the 19th century, the frock coat gradually gave way to a dress coat, which is long but not cutaway, kind of a cross between today's overcoat and a suit jacket. And the reasons for this are really the rise in democracy. For one thing, only very wealthy people could afford hosiery in the 18th century because it tended to be hand-knitted. And the fabric required to knit it, either wool or silk, was very, very fine. And so workers wore trousers. So you've probably heard the phrase the sans-culottes to refer to the mob that stormed the Bastille in Paris. And it's often translated as the without breeches. It wasn't that they didn't have any pants. It was that they were wearing trousers. They weren't wearing breeches, and that showed their class. And actually, the important thing was not their absence of breeches, but their absence of hose, because the socks, the stockings, were actually what was important. More accurately, the sans-culottes, I think, should be called the sans-bas, the tightless. Men stopped dressing up in highly ornate finery with brocade jackets and lace after the French Revolution, because actually in France it became quite dangerous to look like an aristocrat. And various revolutions took place over the course of the 19th century throughout Europe. In France it was 1830, 1848, another one in 1871. In England in 1795 there was a tax put on wig powder, the white powder that made your wig look clean, even though it was usually not very clean. Men, even aristocrats, immediately stopped wearing wigs in England, really from the 1790s on. So really, from the 19th century is the great era of the rise of democracy, and this is really reflected in clothing. And of course, so by the mid-century, all men in Europe are wearing trousers. And the era of male ostentation in dress dies at the beginning of the 19th century. And this was really enshrined by a seminal figure in European fashion. And I keep talking about France because, of course, Paris was a cultural capital. Now, Paris was the capital of women's clothing from the 18th and 19th and the first half of the 20th century. And London was the center of men's clothing and men's tailoring. And I'll tell you a little bit about why that was. And that really applied right through the 19th century and right up until the middle of the 20th century. Let's get back to Paris. There was a king, Louis-Philippe, the so-called bourgeois king of the 1830s, was really scorned by the remaining aristocrats of the time because he dressed like a tradesman. He dressed in the business suit, which the bourgeois suit, which is the short jacket, longer than our jackets today, but it was still shorter than a frock coat, and trousers and a top hat. And he once scandalized the press by appearing in public with a rolled up umbrella, looking like a commuter rather than a king. And this was why he was actually mocked, and the beau monde of the time stopped frequenting the court because they said it was full of tradesmen. Now, I want to talk about another really important character in men's dressing at the beginning of the 19th century, and this is the famous dandy Beau Brummel. Beau Brummel is often referred to as the greatest dandy, the originator of the dandy style. And we think, when you think of dandy, we think of someone who's dressed in a flashy way. Beau Brummel actually was the opposite. Beau Brummel insisted on simplicity of dress. He wore knee breeches, even when they were really falling out of style in the 1840s, because he was a purist. His breeches were extremely tight. He insisted on perfection of cut. His waistcoat fit him like a glove. His overcoat, his frock coat was usually navy blue. His breeches were yellow or tan. His waistcoat was yellow or tan or dove gray. And the perfection was shown in his neckcloth. People wore a very high collar called a stock and made an elaborate knot around it. There's a famous anecdote about Beau Brummel that someone walks in on him dressing at 11 o'clock in his morning, and his valet is helping him dress. And there's a pile of muslin strips of fabric in the middle of the floor. The floor is littered by strips of muslin and silk. And the visitor says, "What are those?" And Brummel, looking at himself in the mirror, says, "Those are our failures." But there was a battle going on between country dressing, which came from England, and Beau Brummel represented that simple country dressing. No lace, no flounces. And court dressing, which was still popular in France, a much more ornate style of dress. And by the late 19th century, the men's suit, which really came from the country, the men's suit as we know it today, had become fixed, and it hasn't changed much since. And there are reasons for this, for the dominance of English tastes over French tastes, even in the cultural capital of the world. Part of the reason is that men's wear, particularly woolen men's wear, in the 19th century, even in the 18th century, late 18th century, was better because the mills, the Industrial Revolution was more advanced in England, and the mills produced higher quality fabric. They had more raw materials from their larger empire in England as well. And also, most importantly of all, English gentlemen lived in the country, whereas in the Ancien Régime in France, in the last days of it, they had all been encouraged to come and live at Versailles, where they did not have to ride around their grounds on horses to check on poachers or whatever they did. An English gentleman rode a lot, hunted, and shot a lot, and so required much more practical, much rougher clothing. These clothes came to represent their more advanced democracy. And so it became very a la mode to, in France in the 19th century, after the revolution, to show that you had been influenced by English ideals of democracy. And bear in mind, we're going to get to 1905 soon, I promise you. But I'm not going to talk about Germanic cultures. I'm not going to talk about Germany or Switzerland, where Einstein was in 1905, because nobody would have. Simply, those were cultural. those are cultural backwaters. Only Vienna in the German-speaking world would have been culturally and fashion-wise important. Everyone in the world would have looked at Paris for women's clothes and London for men's clothes at that time. So let's go back to women's clothes, and I'll just trace the revolution in the 19th century. The female, this line here, there's no waist defined, but the line under the bust became known, as you still know it today, as the Empire Line, because this is Napoleon's empire. And that waistline drops again to the natural waist at about 1822. And at 1822, the corset comes back in again, the skirt grows extremely wide, and the sleeves puff out. And that's that classic 19th century silhouette that you're so familiar with. In the 1840s, Victoria comes to the throne in England in 1837, and women's fashion continue their trend towards modesty, sobriety, and absurd excess of fabric. So you've seen all those pictures of Victorian women in the 1850s. There was a ludicrous proliferation of petticoats, leading to the introduction of the hooped cage, because the petticoats are actually fashion demanded they'd be so voluminous they couldn't actually, just the weight of flounces couldn't actually stay wide enough out. And so they introduced those actual hooped cages. That gave way in the 1860s and the 1870s, thank God for women, to the bustle, which was that a smaller cage just placed on the tailbone that makes the skirt very pronounced in the back. And of course, the skirt still went down right to the floor. You would not have seen many ankles. That is Monet from 1866. I really only want to show you this painting because I love it, so it's so beautiful. These are summer dresses, though. This is about as light as your clothing could go. And you know, it gets pretty hot in France. Hence the parasol. Hence all the fainting. These women would have been wearing corsets, and they would have had several layers of petticoats under these as well. So here we see that in a very short time, that evolution from a very bare, very revealing and very loose and flowing style, even among the most privileged people, to this much more modest. Now, here's where an era of ostentation begins in the 1890s. This is Beardsley, a caricature of very expensive dress from 1894. Let me just talk about this time. There were a couple of different things going on in the 1890s in Europe. First of all, there was a cycling craze. And women took up cycling as well. Well, obviously, they had to have a different kind of clothing if they were going to cycle. And so a lot of them wore men's jackets, men's high collars, and ties. And I'll show you some pictures of women cycling or playing golf wearing men's jackets and ties. Why? Well, because if you're going to do men's activities, you should dress like a man. That's the only reason, really, I could think of. Obviously, you couldn't cycle in an outfit like this. This is a very formal evening outfit. This is an opera outfit. There was a movement in the 1880s and 90s. And this is a drawing by Aubrey Beardsley, and it was an illustration for Oscar Wilde's play Salome, 1894. Oscar Wilde was part of a movement called themselves the Aesthetes. And they were associated with a movement called rational dress, or dress reform. Wilde supported the rational dress movement. Another person very much involved with the rational dress movement was Mrs. Amelia Bloomer, who developed a practical outfit for cycling, which involved puffy trousers, which became known as bloomers. There was a massive public outcry against the rational dress movement, which suggested looser, more comfortable clothing for women. It was widely parodied in the press, and the idea that most people, particularly in England and Britain, had was that it would make a mockery of men to have women dressing in comfortable clothing. There were lots of cartoons in Punch, the comic journal of the day, of extremely masculine women with bicycles and timid, effeminate, henpecked men scurrying around them. And so the rational dress movement never really caught on. Now, this really typifies the era that we're coming close to, the 1890s, leading into the Edwardian era in Britain, which became known as the Belle Époque, because it's famous as an era of great excess, great disparity between rich and poor, great social ostentation, and great extravagance. This is another drawing, a Beardsley drawing, which, again, it's not really important. It's just a really, really beautiful drawing of Salome's toilette. Salome, the illustrations are all from contemporary life, even though the play is set in biblical times. And this would have been a caricature of an elaborate opera dress of 1894. So even up to around 1900, you would have seen some décolletage, some bare necks, and a lot of cleavage. This is a ball from Vienna, 1900. And you can see a lot of bare shoulders, some bare backs, and a great deal of male ostentation as well. These are military officers, of course. The Viennese were much more flamboyant, though, than the British at this time. Now, the Edwardian era in Britain is very famous. This is King Edward VII, who was famous as a fashion plate even when he was the Prince of Wales. It's a little confusing because his name is Albert. He was Prince Albert. He was known affectionately by the British press as Bertie. And then he took on the name Edward when he became king on Victoria's death in 1901. And he was a huge influence on fashion and social life, and the press reported meticulously every outfit that he wore. He is credited with introducing many changes in men's fashion, which we still follow today. I'll give you a couple of examples. He was a bon vivant. He loved fast women and fast horses. And he didn't mind socializing with the nouveau riche. He didn't only socialize with other people of high birth. And he ate a little bit too much. He popularized plaids, particularly in tweed suits, because his mother had a castle in Scotland, Balmoral, and he used to go there and really loved life in Balmoral. And when there, would wear Scotch clothes, which includes a lot of plaids and checks. And so English gentlemen of London started dressing like Scottish country squires in an effort to look something like Prince Albert. So he really brought in plaids into the contemporary suit. Because he put on too much weight, he would often, after dinner, undo the bottom button on his waistcoat. By the way, tailors still today pronounce the waistcoat waistcoat. So he would undo the bottom button on his waistcoat. And to this day, you do not do up the bottom button of your waistcoat. This is a rule that became established because of Bertie. And the other thing that he did was, because he liked to go to races, he would have to go and check out the horses in the paddock, and he would roll up the bottom of his trouser legs so they didn't get muddy. And that led to cuffs that we see on most trousers today. It was actually a lot of sporting men at the time were doing that from the 1890s on, but he was, of course, the most famous and was photographed and caused a scandal when this photograph appeared of him in a top hat at Ascot with cuffs turned up. And still, if you go to have a suit made at Savile Row, they don't call them cuffs, trouser cuffs, they call them PTUs, permanent turn-ups. If you see the abbreviation, if you're having a suit made PTU, it means you're having cuffs on your trousers. I'm full of very, very useful information. Now, the Edwardian era, like the Belle Époque in France, was a time of great extravagance among the privileged, and it's been called the last good time of the upper classes. And I want to do a digression to just show you a famous dandy in France of this era. This is a count by the name of Boniface de Castellane, known as Boni. And he was a famous dandy. Again, the French press reported on his every outfit. But as you can see, it's still very much with some slight changes, an outfit that we would call conservative. The minute details that made him a dandy are very hard to point out unless you were around at the time. The French used the term to describe ostentatious luxury. They used the term le igliffe, which was a pronunciation of the English terms high life, the high life. And he was the embodiment of high life. He held parties in Paris, and one of them, I got the details on this party, dinner for 150 close friends, followed by a reception for 4,000 guests at the Bois de Boulogne, for which he hired the ballet corps of the Paris Opera. 200 musicians, 80,000 green Venetian lanterns, and 10 miles of carpeting. And it cost him 300,000 francs in 1890s francs, which I have no idea what that would be today, but you can imagine. I got a couple more pictures of him. This is him a little bit older. This is in 1923. But you can see the spats were still being used in 1923. And he has not got the bottom button of his waistcoat undone because he's French. Because he's not English. An Englishman would have had the bottom one done up. That ribbon is a watch fob. And notice this flower, which in England you call a buttonhole. The buttonhole is not the buttonhole, it's the flower. Okay, you notice this if you read Oscar Wilde's plays. They say, I must have a buttonhole for tonight. Doesn't mean I have to put a hole in my lapel, it means I must have a flower. And the buttonhole had to be perfect. The British poet George Selwyn actually devised a small flask attached to the back of his lapel filled with water to keep his flower fresh, his buttonhole fresh. And this is Bonny in old age. I think this is just a marvelous image of dandyism. Again, dandyism does not mean bright color. All these people were dressed in very, very neutral colors. But note the pocket square in the pocket of the overcoat. That's a dandy. Now, did women's fashions reflect this kind of sensuality or decadence? Not at all. And this is something I find very strange about the turn of the century. There was certainly a lot of fabric. There was a passion for lace, for hats, for gloves, but very little flesh exposed. So modernizer was extremely modest, even prudish. And the ideal woman of the fashion images of 1905 was a mature woman. She was a married lady, a society lady. She was not the sexy teenager of today, or even of the 1920s, where the focus shifted to young women. So I have some images here. This is 1905. No, it's 1907. Sorry, that's a fabulous hat from 1907. Note she's wearing gloves indoors as well. You would wear gloves. Those are theater gloves for 1907. And again, you can see that's a daytime outfit, and the neck goes very high, right up. It's going right up under her chin. That's French. These are men in Paris in 1900. And as you can see, the very wealthy men, these are lower middle class men, I would think. And very wealthy men would have worn a longer coat, a dress-up coat, and this is called the dress coat. But these men are wearing the even shorter coat, obviously the precursor of the suits we wore today, which was called the lounge coat. And as you can see, aside from the high collars, they're no longer wearing bow ties, they're wearing straight ties. There are very, very few variations that have happened, really, from 1880 to the present day. In fact, if you follow the contemporary line, Itro, who's selling suits in Harry Rosen and Holt Renfrew, they're looking almost exactly the same cut as that this season. And the shoes, too, you can see are almost identical. The only thing we don't wear much anymore is hats. These are Americans. Now, I'm not focusing much on the United States because, again, they would not have looked anywhere but Paris for their outfits. So these wealthy Americans, this is in Newport, Rhode Island, where millionaires hung out. This is 1900. All of these fashions would have come from Paris. And again, I just want you to note the coverage that these women had. This is an American couple from 1905, and you can see that is the dress coat that I'm talking about, the longer coat. That's not an outdoor coat, that's an indoor coat. It hasn't yet given way to the shorter lounge coat. That's a very wealthy couple. That's an American lady of 1906. And you can see the bust, there's a corset. And you can see the corset is giving her the famous S-curve. Her body is supposed to be shaped like an S. It's a backwards S in this case, but you see what I mean. Because the corset pushes the chest out and the hips back. But it does not make the bust prominent. The bust is it's desirable if the bust is quite heavy, but as you can see, it's completely covered by that, by all that fabric. This is a ball gown, and a lovely ball gown. I wish I could get a bigger picture of it, but that's silk. And as you can see, if you did dress up to a special ball, you could show some of your back and your neck and your forearms. But this would have been extremely for privileged people, and really quite exciting, probably, for men to see. That's an afternoon dress, and that is French, and that's 1907. And again, you can see that there's a faux bust line, a square one, but actually she's got fabric right up to the neck. And no ankles. That is not a great image, but this is a weird garment from this time called a tea gown. A tea gown was something you only wore indoors. And it resembles lingerie to a certain extent. There were a lot of sheer layers, but again, you couldn't see through it. There are too many layers. And you may have had some kind of mesh garment underneath it going up to your neck as well. That's for entertaining at home. There's a famous line of Ezra Pound, the beginning of Hugh Selwyn Moberly begins, the tea rose tea gown. I have no idea what the rest of the poem means, but it's a lovely line, the tea rose tea gown. This is a French dress from 1907. And again, you can see that famous S line due to the corset. This is what you would have worn to go outside. French dresses, 1907. Extremely narrow waist. And of course, these are caricatures to exaggerate, but extremely narrow waist and quite a low but heavy bust line. These are sports outfits. This is men's golfing on your left and women's tennis on your right. And again, the woman, you can't really see from this slide, but the woman is wearing a high man's collar and a small white tie to look like a man because she is doing athletic activity. Here you see the same thing, a lady's golfing costume on your left with the tie, but again, extremely narrow waist with the corset and a day dress from 1907. She also has something like a men's tie on the day dress of 1907. These are privileged people at the races in 1906. Again, the sheer volume of fabric that woman is wearing just amazes me. And a train. And the train would drag in the mud and would usually get muddy. One of the things that the rational dress reformers of the 1890s did not like was this habit of dragging mud through people's houses on your trains. They said, why don't we make dresses shorter? Because they'll be a little easier to keep clean. This is just a lovely picture. I just love this. It's an evening coat, ladies' evening coat for 1905. It's just the sheer handicraft that would go into that is amazing. And these are men's outdoor clothes from 1907. And the one on the left is a summer outfit, and so would have been for poplin or linen. And again, would have been extremely hot. You could not have gone around wearing anything less than this in 1907. Buttoned up all over the place. Now, I'm going to show you a couple pictures of underwear, although God knows one could do an entire lecture on underwear. I could in particular become extremely distracted by the underwear of the time. But it was very complicated, so I'll just show you a couple of different things. This is a contemporary model wearing underwear of 1905. So she's got an undershirt, and then over the undershirt she's got the corset, and those are bloomers. That's her underpants, are those long bloomers. Over the corset you would wear this, which is a corset cover. And the idea of the corset cover was largely, because your dress was quite tight in the waist, it was to camouflage the boning in the corset so it wouldn't be visible from outside. Also, don't forget, houses were colder then, so you did need to wear more layers because there wasn't central heating. This is a pair of bloomers from 1905 with a beautiful elaborate lace underneath. But it's unusual because most of the bloomers at the time were open at the crotch. So that you didn't have to take them off to go to the bathroom. Because imagine the difficulty involved in lifting your skirt up, getting them down, then getting them back, lifting your skirt up again to get them back up. So they just didn't take them off. They were just split at the crotch. Although, as I said, the underwear is a lecture on its own. So we'll have to leave underwear behind for the moment. Although it must be said that there was a great deal of pornography being made at the time, and the pornography did fetishize the underwear to a great deal. There was very little nudity in the pornography. The pornography usually involved play with the underwear, as it does today. This is just a picture of shoes, men's and women's shoes mixed. You can see there wasn't all that much distinction between men's and women's shoes. This is 1909, actually, the shoes. And there was a great deal of lacing to be done, a great deal of buttoning. As you know, you needed a hook to get those very small buttons through the very small eyelets. And here we have a women's cycling outfit of 1909, and you see the bloomers. But you also see those very full sleeves, which are really a 19th century holdover, and a very narrow waist, and again, the men's tie and men's collar for athletic wear. Now, we've only been discussing clothing of the wealthy so far. Their clothing was, obviously, it interests the fashion historian the most because it's the most luxurious. But also, we have fewer records of working people's clothes because they didn't have their photos taken or their portraits painted nearly so often. So I just have one picture to show you here. These are French workers of 1905. They're wearing a smock, double-breasted smocks, and you still see workmen in France wearing these today. The blue smock is a very similar pattern. The hats are very similar. Corduroy trousers, much looser, much more practical clothing. And this is where our discussion of the art of the period begins. Why is that? Well, think of how today artists like to dress like workers. And they like to think of themselves as workers. And to affect workers' dress, even if they themselves may be of the most privileged classes or educations. And this is part of the artistic tradition that we really take for granted now of bohemianism. And it's an artistic tradition of generally left-wing tendencies. And I know, coming from the arts, the world of the arts, that this is by and large true. But that's something that was not at all entrenched in the 19th century. Artists were feted, patronized by the privileged classes. They did not necessarily feel antagonistic towards the privileged classes. We kind of assume that they're going to be now. Artists of the 19th century, particularly if they were successful, would have dressed like the bourgeoisie. So this association of artist equals avant-gardist equals Marxist is really only just beginning to begin in 1905. And I want to show you a fascinating picture here of an artist in 1907. This is the Dutch painter, Kees van Dongen, who's living in Paris. And as you can see, he's dressing like a worker. That's him with the beard there. And the other two are also artists. Now let's just go back and see. Look at the corduroy trousers here. Corduroy trousers he's wearing. He's dressing deliberately and defiantly like a worker out of solidarity for the working class. Okay, so what's going on in the art of 1905? Modernism is really brewing. This guy, Kees van Dongen, was part of the movement called the Fauves, the wild beasts. And he took part, Matisse is the most famous of the wild beasts. Durand and Dufy or others. He took part, van Dongen took part in the controversial fall salon, the Salon d'Automne of 1905. So at this time in Vienna, Egon Schiele is experimenting with his very stark and troubling imagery, which prefigures expressionism. Picasso is painting, but he hasn't yet begun to paint cubes. In Munich, the Russian Vasily Kandinsky is painting portraits, and he's beginning to experiment with impressionistic, semi-abstract representations. But the great shock of modernism has not yet hit the general public. The words modern art, after about 1912, mean controversy. The word modern art implies a sneer to most middle-class people and almost everybody after 1912. And at this point, 1905, they do not carry the word modern art, really doesn't mean anything. It does to the average person, the average newspaper reader. It doesn't carry the accusation of fraud that I would argue it still carries today. This happens just after 1905. So Marinetti's Futurist Manifesto is published 4 years later, 1909. By the way, there's a sign in the lobby that says it's 1905. I panicked when I got here. I saw that sign in the lobby. I immediately demanded to find an internet. And I'm right, it's 1909, it's not 1905. And a very important thing start to happen just after, in culture and art, just after 1905. The Ballet Russe, the Russian ballet led by Diaghilev, comes to Paris in 1909, and they were a very important influence on art of the period. They were very revolutionary. What the Ballet Russe were trying to do were capture Russian styles of music in opposition to Germanic styles, which had dominated the 19th century. And so they performed the ballet Scheherazade, Rimsky-Korsakov's music, Scheherazade, in 1909. It had very innovative choreography and a very outrageous, colorful, loose, oriental costumes. They were called oriental by the French press. And that plays Paris 1910. Now, Kandinsky's first abstract works are painted 1910. Cubism gets going 1905 to 1909. The real big shocks to the public happen 1912, 1913. What happens in 1912? Stravinsky's Rite of Spring is performed in Paris. The music was so upsetting to people, there were fistfights in the audience. In New York, the first exposure of the American public to this particularly Cubist art, was 1913 at the famous Armory Show, which also caused a great derision. And in that show, Marcel Duchamp's famous Cubist painting, The Nude Descending a Staircase, was shown in 1913, and it was much derided and parodied by the American press. And then after that comes 1914. We know what happens in 1914. All hell breaks loose, both physically and artistically, with the beginning of the First World War. Now, in fashion, a major turning point, again, is just after 1905. It's 1907. I'll tell you what that is. It's the designer Paul Poiret, P-O-I-R-E-T, and he comes out. He's very influenced by the Russian ballet, and he comes out with a collection of what he calls empire dresses. So these are drawings of Poiret's collection of 1908. As you can see, the waistline has come right back up to under the bust. The dresses are loose. There's a lot of flesh exposed, and the hair is shorter. And this illustration, which is done by the famous illustrator Paul Iribe, is very symbolic. The women in color are looking into the past in black and white, in which a woman is wearing 19th century clothing. So this is really, he really thought that he was introducing a new century with these clothes. That's Poiret dresses of 1908 as well. And again, it looks to me, it's starting to look like the fashion we think of as Virginia Woolf's imagery of Bloomsbury, which we think of the 1920s and 30s. This is where I think a 20th century image, a silhouette starts to emerge. Paul Poiret, 1908. I mean, it starts to look a bit like Art Deco, doesn't it? This is a gorgeous evening gown. This is very much influenced by Scheherazade and the Ballet Russe costumes, what they called Orientalist dress. Very bright color, bold patterns. And you can see her ankles as well. And this is a Poiret party dress of 1913. So as you can see, everything, all the rules go out. By 1913, things really change very dramatically in a way they haven't changed in fashion for 50 years. That starts to look like the flapper silhouette of the 1920s. Now, Poiret is a very interesting person because Poiret, too, is the first fashion designer to take on the social role of fashion designer that we now know today. One of the first, but there were a couple around his time, but he's an interesting one. He became so popular. All these dresses are couture dresses, by the way. These are not ready-made. You have to have this dress made for you by him. So ladies would have to have an appointment with him. He became so popular that you could not get an appointment with him unless you were introduced to him, preferably by someone important and famous. And some very important and famous ladies showed up, made an appointment and showed up. And he was apparently a very nervous, very tiny, very skinny man who chain-smoked, very arrogant man, and he would say, "Madam, have we been introduced?" And if the lady said no, he would say, "I'm afraid I can't dress you if we haven't been introduced." And the ladies would risk this mortification just because it was so important to get a Paul Poiret dress. Now, it's only at this time that the connection we now take for granted between avant-garde art and fashion really begins to solidify. After 1905, Poiret had been fascinated by the textile workshops of the Wiener Werkstätte, which are the Vienna workshops, in which Gustav Klimt had been involved, where they had been trying to fuse avant-garde art, or high art, and craft, loosely based on the ideas of William Morris and the arts and crafts movement in England. Now, the Wiener Werkstätte were founded in 1903. Klimt began to design what he called art dresses before 1910. They established a textile workshop in 1905, and the director of the textile workshop entered into a dialogue with Poiret and with Liberty of London. Poiret visited Vienna, 1911, and he bought large quantities of fabric back from the Wiener Werkstätte, and he also commissioned some early modern artists, such as the Fauvist, Giffy, and Durin, to make fabric designs for him. And that is the beginning of this association between artists and designers that was really to take off in the 1920s. You may know the work of Elsa Schiaparelli, who was very influenced by surrealists. So just to recap that change in silhouette, this is a silhouette of 1905, and these drawings are done by Pauline Weston Thomas, who's a fashion historian, who simplifies stylizes these lines so you can just get an idea of the silhouette. That's the silhouette of 1905. That's the silhouette of 1910. So the 1905, to me, really looks like a 19th century silhouette. And now we're starting to look more like the cylindrical, barrel-like silhouette of the 20th century there. I want to do a slight digression here to show you a fascinating fashion of 1910. This is called, let's go back a little bit. We'll get to the hobble garter in a second. Let's just go over the difference here between 1905 and 1910. The next slides I'm going to show you are the crux of my whole argument. And there are four paintings. This is Picasso 1905. That is a Picasso of 1905. His blue period. And this is a Picasso of 1910. That's it right there. Boom. This is a Kandinsky of 1905. And this is a Kandinsky of 1910. I can't say it any better than that. That's usually regarded as the first abstract painting, completely abstract painting. Even this Picasso here is representational. It's representing something. I forget what this one is, but it's got a title like "Man with Dictionary" or something like that. Whereas this one is called composition. Now I'm going to give my slight digression of a weird fashion of 1910. This is called the hobble garter and the hobble dress. These were dresses, and Poiret did some like this as well, which were voluminous in the skirt and had a band of fabric, as you can see right here, just going underneath your knees so that you couldn't walk. And you actually had to wear this garter underneath it to keep your legs together so that you would not be tempted to take too large strides. I have an illustration here of that's a Poiret dress of around the same time with the hobble style. Interestingly, and I discovered this somewhat by accident because I typed in hobble dress into a search engine, a lot of people are wearing hobble dresses right now in the sadomasochistic community. I found myself suddenly looking at a lot of pictures of black leather and latex hobble dresses. And I just think that's really interesting that these fashions don't die, they become fetishized. This was short-lived, the hobble dress, but in main fashion, but then went underground, as I can say, you can buy one tonight if you want. Now, after this point, the artistic and social revolutions become ever more frenzied and ever more shocking because the First World War really destroys European society in a sense that it weakens class structure. And it gives rise to Dadaism, which begins in 1915. And Dadaism gives rise to what we now call conceptual art. It's the first conceptual art in which the object being shown is not important, but the concept it represents is important, or the thinking behind it. The Russian Revolution happens in 1917, encouraging all sorts of avant-garde art. At the beginning, at least, they cracked down pretty quickly, but at the beginning, abstraction and futurist abstraction was very much encouraged. And avant-garde art, from that moment on, was associated with leftism because the Soviets encouraged it so much. And the Soviet avant-gardists tried to influence fashion, everyday fashion, through theater costumes influenced by geometric abstraction and plans for workers' outfits. This is a Popova theater costume, 1921. Obviously influenced by futurist and suprematist painting of Kazimir Majevich, for example. And this is a sports costume by Stepanova. And I love this because this really could come from the 1950s in the United States, I think. This is fashion as we know it today, these loose geometric shapes and geometric patterns and bright colors. This is a fascinating piece of work from 1919. This is a really utopian idea. An Italian called Ernesto Tayat, who was a friend of the futurists, designed this one-piece overall for men and women called the tuta, the universal garment. And this was really Marxist idealism, that we'd all workers united of all classes would really want to dress the same way. Here's a picture of the tuta. Vestito universale tutto di un pezzo, one piece. There are lots of Russian drawings like this, very similar to this at the same time. And now I'm just going to show you some pictures from the 1920s to show what modernism did to fashion. These are drawings by Sonia Delaunay, the wife of Robert Delaunay. They were early cubists. They called themselves simultaneists. And they were friends with Tristan Tzara and the futurists. And Delaunay designed these geometric simultaneous dresses in the 1920s. This is Tristan Zara, the Dadaist, wearing a scarf that was actually designed by Sonia Delaunay. And the painting is by Robert Delaunay. These are some Sonia Delaunay bathing suits of 1928, obviously influenced by abstract painting. And obviously, think of that silhouette I showed you of 1905. I mean, just completely unthinkable at that time. So 1905 is before these cultural revolutions take place. And now I'm just going to skip, because it's fun, to the 1920s. There are some 1920s. But think of how close those Paul Poiret dresses of 1908 really were to this. I mean, the hemline's risen quite a bit. And there is no waist, even an empire line, in these. The ideal of the flapper was to have no breasts at all. It was a very boyish silhouette and very short hair. That's the famous bob that you're seeing there. That's the Tamara de Lempicka from, I don't know, around 1930. And again, it starts to look reminiscent of 1800 again, doesn't it? Very bare. And look at this one, very loose, like Hellenic drapery. Look at that one. That is an evening dress. It's exaggerated, of course, for effect, but it's very bare and reminds me very much of the dress of Madame Récamier in 1802 that we saw. And there was another... here's an image of decadence from the German Impressionist Otto Dix. All these women showing their legs, showing their shoulders, showing their backs, showing their cleavage. Unthinkable in 1905. This was unthinkable in 1905, too. This is a caricature by Otto Dix of a female journalist, and he's exaggerating her masculine traits because this was fashionable. Cut your hair short, wear a monocle, smoke, which would have been, even in the 1920s, shocking for a woman. You have to be pretty daring to smoke, even more daring to smoke in 1905. And look how he exaggerates her hands, the size of her hands, just to exaggerate her masculinity there. But you actually saw this kind of dress. That's a picture from the races, 1926. And there's a lady affecting, as a form of fashion, masculine garb. This would have been raised a lot of eyebrows even in 1926. This was not popular in small towns. You had to be pretty sophisticated to dress this. But I think that those trousers, you know, even though the ladies in 1905 were wearing those high collars and ties, the trousers would have been completely unimaginable. And this is my last slide. This is a futurist jacket of 1931. And this is the 20th century aesthetic that we're so familiar with now. I mean, that could be sporting wear of the late 20th century. That's 1931. To my mind, the culture and the aesthetic of 1905 still belongs to the 19th century. And to me, the 20th century really begins with the First World War. Although I'm tempted to say it begins with the Rite of Spring, since that was so important. And to think, too, that Einstein, living in Switzerland, not in artistic circles in Paris or London, would have been totally untouched by these social developments. I know little about Einstein, but I understand he wasn't terribly interested in fashion. sartorially, socially, culturally, Einstein was living in the 19th century, which makes his 20th century thinking all the more amazing. That's the end of my lecture, and now you can ask me any questions you like. Thank you.
We have ushers with microphones. If you have a question, please raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. There's a question right here, please.
That was very interesting. Thank you very much. When did color start to make its presence felt?
Yeah, really not until Poiret. It was really Orientalism. It was really the Ballet Russe that brought bright color in. There were very pale and muted colors, both in ladies' and men's wear, in 1905. It's hard to tell, too, from illustrations. You know, those drawings I showed you of ladies' dresses of 1907 were in bright green. It's really hard to tell how closely those illustrations approximate the actual colors. I'm sure there was color, there was green. But the palette of 1905 was pastel, it was grays. For women, it was beige, yellow, fawn, and that sort of thing. And for men, it was the dark suit, and sometimes in summer a pale suit, but all in neutral tones, even in summer. So again, I really think that comes. I mean, you can even see from my illustrations those that the surge of color that happens when Cubism influences fashion in the 1920s. So I really think that the Ballet Russe had a lot to do with that. So 1909, 1910. Yeah, but I wish we had color photographs of the time. You know, I can't actually be sure. We're looking at illustrations, so it's really hard to tell. I mean, there are a lot of costumes. I've seen actual ones, and they are all the ladies' dresses are very muted, very from 1905. Yeah.
That one-piece Russian tuta, how did one go to the bathroom?
Well, I think you had to take it off. It was an overall, and it buttoned up the front. So you'd unbutton it, and you just let it drop. Underwear, you could do hours on underwear. I mean, I am fascinated to know what futurist underwear would look like.
Now you know why it is that women like to go to the bathroom together, right? They need help. We know that the wealthy got their clothing from haute couture shops, designers. Where did the working class go to buy their clothing?
There was a rise of what we now call off the rack, which they called at the turn of the century in England tailor-made, which is funny because tailor-made to us now means made to measure. But actually, a tailor-made meant a ready-to-wear that was sold in shops. There would have been the rise of that, and it depends on what country you're in Europe, but it really starts in the late 19th century, so from sort of 1860 onwards. You didn't have to go to a tailor to get things made for you, although all the wealthy people certainly did. By 1910, even wealthy women were wearing these so-called tailor-mades or ready-mades to non-formal events in public, even that you would have seen even some in 1910. But tailors worked for working people and for the privileged. So working people before the rise of the ready-made would still have gone and got fitted out for a suit of clothes. They just would have had a less expensive suit of clothes fitted out than the wealthy people, and probably much simpler. And of course, that elaborate fabric, the elaborate lace, the elaborate embroidery that we're looking at from the privileged is there to show to everyone that you can afford it. That's the point of wearing it. Look, you still see this today. The less practical the clothing you're wearing, the higher the social class you are, it tends to be today. If you go, I'm struck by downtown Toronto in the summer, when it's 37 degrees and humid and smoggy and unbearable. And you see guys walking around in suits like this one, outdoors, because they don't have to stay outdoors for very long. They're moving from one air-conditioned environment to another. The couriers who are delivering their mail are wearing shorts and tank tops, and that utter impracticability, the impracticalness of the privileged outfit is a deliberate symbol that you do not ever have to exert yourself. And that's exactly the same as it was at the turn of the century. It hasn't changed.
Question down here.
I just keep going on that for a second. In the late Renaissance in Spain, Spanish noblemen began wearing black, and particularly black velvet. If you've ever been to Spain, you know that that is the least practical outfit to wear in Spain. Those elaborate ruffs and black velvet bodices, doubloons, breeches, and tights. And again, the point of wearing black velvet in Spain was to show that you did not ever have to stand in the sun. Sure, go ahead.
In view of your review of post-Napoleonic, post-Empire clothes for ladies, we know that George Sand in the 1830s yeah. wore a man's suit.
Yeah.
Did other women follow that? Did that start a little mini trend, or
yeah,
she was
question.
Unique?
I don't know, to be honest, the answer to your question. I suspect she was unique. I mean, she was shocking for various reasons, and that is certainly one of them. There was an interesting blip of all fashion In the first half of the 19th century, due to the influence of the Romantic poets, and in particular Byron, that men and women wanted to dress like Romantic artists and wore much looser clothing. Particularly men wore baggy trousers and loose sort of pirate shirts and loose scarves rather than high knots and capes and things. And artists were tolerated because they were broken geniuses, and I think perhaps Jausson would have. But I mean, I think it's interesting that we know that about Jausson, which shows how exceptional it was. That's what I think. But I don't know. I mean, I would like to do more research on the salons of that time, because you might be right. Maybe she caused a trend. There's a scene in Yves Lenoir from a novel from the 1920s in which it's Vile Bodies, in which the bright young things from London go to the races in the country and are put up in an inn. And a drunk old man from the country points at young Agatha Runcible, who's wearing trousers. And they say, "Let the lady go," or something. And he says, "Lady? Trousers!" and won't help her, because a lady, even in the 1920s, wouldn't wear trousers.
Question at the top.
Would lower class women have worn corsets also?
Yes. Yes. I can't see who's speaking. Where are you? Yes. Yes, they would have. And you would be expected to work if you were, say, a washerwoman or something. You would probably wear a corset as well. Certainly when you went out, if you went out in the streets, you would wear a corset, yeah. There was great disparity, of course, in European capitals at this time between the rich and the poor. And many poor people couldn't have afforded any of these fashions. So you wore a corset if you could afford one. But I think if you could afford one, yes, you would.
So my question is about a more recent fashion development. It's about what happened to men's hats. It seems that for a really long time, that was part of the men's attire. And then at some point, I don't know, it was 1960, it disappeared and just never came back. Do you have any thoughts about that?
It's so weird, because it is as if there was an edict passed around the world on New Year's Eve 1960. and it is 1960. There are theories. We never know why these things happen. But there is one theory, and that is, John F. Kennedy's inauguration, which was, I think, 61, he gave his speech hatless, and this caused a lot of discussion in the press. Now, it was conventional for a president to be inaugurated wearing a top hat, and he had a top hat, which he was wearing while seated. There were kind of bleachers, and he was wearing a top hat and was visible from afar, so everyone could see that's the president. From afar. When he got up to make his speech, there were TV cameras on him, and he didn't wear a hat. And this shocked a lot of commentators, and people say it set a trend. I don't know if it was solely that, but I don't know why. It was the 1960s. They just dropped out, because you really would not have been considered properly dressed in the 1930s or 40s had you gone outside. A man not wearing a hat. That's the urban myth. The legend is it was JFK, but I don't know.
Yeah. Let's take one last question up here.
Hi. Do you think that art influences fashion today? And if so, what are your thoughts? Is it going up or down compared to the past?
Yeah, I think art is very much influencing fashion. Now, of course, I'm blanking on specific details, but I think it has right through the 20th century, that fashion designers love to associate with artists, and they love looking at images, because their work is of surfaces, and the artist's work is about surfaces. I would say probably fashion influences art more than the other way around, but I do think they're symbiotic. Think of Issey Miyake and Christo. That's a parallel I would make. Christo, the guy who raps, there are a lot of pleats in his rapping. Issey Miyake is famous for very finely pleated clothing. I think that's just one parallel that comes to mind. think of some more. I'm blanking now. I'll think of some more as soon as I stop. But yeah, and I think that's going to continue. I think that fashion designers are always looking at fine art for materials in particular, new textures. I mean, I just know from frequenting both circles that they're in contact. They're in contact a lot. And if you look at a show like FT, sorry.
It's your show.
If you look like at a show like FT, the fashion media tend to cover fine art more than the regular media do. They always have an art section where they talk about a photographer or something. Because fashion has to pay attention to art because it's of the zeitgeist, you know.
Well, Russell, I don't know that you can, I'm not sure that you can do anything, but you certainly can give a great talk, and really appreciate you being here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks. Was I on time?
So, ladies and gentlemen, much more to come in Einstein Fest over the next couple of weeks. If you have not picked up a program, please pick one up in the lobby. Tonight at 8:30 in the Black Hole Bistro, jazz every Friday and Saturday night during Einstein Fest, jazz. Tonight we present the Dave Young Trio. Dave Young, one of the finest jazz bass players you will find anywhere on this planet. You're welcome to come and join us up in the Black Hole Bistro. Thank you very much for coming tonight.